Chapter 9.
It began quietly, as the fateful unexpected so often begins. Children, of all ages and sizes, were playing in the street, and Saxon, by the open front window, was watching them and dreaming daydreams of her child soon-to-be. The sunshine mellowed peacefully down, and a light wind from the bay cooled the air and gave to it a tang of salt. One of the children pointed up Pine Street toward 7th. All the children ceased playing and stared and pointed. They formed into groups, the larger boys, of from 10 to 12, by themselves, the older girls anxiously clutching the small children by the hands or gathering them into their arms. Saxon could not see the cause of all this, but she could guess when she saw the larger boys rush to the gutter, pick up stones, and sneak into the alleys between the houses. Smaller boys tried to imitate them. The girls, dragging the tots by the arms, banged gates and clattered up the front steps of the small houses. The doors slammed behind them, and the street was deserted, though here and there front shades were drawn aside so that anxious-faced women might peer forth. Saxon heard the uptown train puffing and snorting as it pulled out from Center Street. Then, from the direction of 7th, came a hoarse, throaty man roar. Still, she could see nothing, and she remembered Mercedes Higgins' words, "They are like dogs wrangling over bones. Jobs are bones, do you know?" The roar came closer, and Saxon, leaning out, saw a dozen scabs, conveyed by as many special police and Pinkertons, coming down the sidewalk on her side of the street. They came compactly, as if with discipline, while behind, disorderly, yelling confusedly, stooping to pick up rocks, were 75 or 100 of the striking shopmen. Saxon discovered herself trembling with apprehension, knew that she must not, and controlled herself. She was helped in this by the conduct of Mercedes Higgins. The old woman came out of her front door, dragging a chair, on which she coolly seated herself on the tiny stoop at the top of the steps. In the hands of the special police were clubs. The Pinkertons carried no visible weapons. The strikers, urging on from behind, seemed content with yelling their rage and threats, and it remained for the children to precipitate the conflict. From across the street, between the Olson and the Isham houses, came a shower of stones. Most of these fell short, though one struck a scab on the head. The man was no more than 20 feet away from Saxon. He reeled toward her front picket fence, drawing a revolver. With one hand he brushed the blood from his eyes, and with the other he discharged the revolver into the Isham house. A Pinkerton seized his arm to prevent a second shot and dragged him along. At the same instant a wilder roar went up from the strikers, while a volley of stones came from between Saxon's house and Maggie Donahue's. The scabs and their protectors made a stand, drawing revolvers. From their hard, determined faces, fighting men by profession, Saxon could augur nothing but bloodshed and death. An elderly man, evidently the leader, lifted a soft felt hat and mopped the perspiration from the bald top of his head. He was a large man, very rotund of belly and helpless-looking. His gray beard was stained with streaks of tobacco juice, and he was smoking a cigar. He was stoop-shouldered, and Saxon noted the dandruff on the collar of his coat. One of the men pointed into the street, and several of his companions laughed. The cause of it was the little Olson boy, barely 4 years old, escaped somehow from his mother, and toddling toward his economic enemies. In his right he bore a rock so heavy that he could scarcely lift it. With this he feebly threatened them. His rosy little face was convulsed with rage, and he was screaming over and over, "Damn scabs! Damn scabs! Damn scabs!" The laughter with which they greeted him only increased his fury. He toddled closer, and with a mighty exertion threw the rock. It fell a scant 6 feet beyond his hand. This much Saxon saw, and also Mrs. Olson rushing into the street for her child. A rattling of revolver shots from the strikers drew Saxon's attention to the men beneath her. One of them cursed sharply and examined the biceps of his left arm, which hung limply by his side. Down the hand she saw the blood beginning to drip. She knew she ought not remain and watch, but the memory of her fighting for fathers was with her, while she possessed no more than normal human fear, if anything, less. She forgot her child in the eruption of battle that had broken upon her quiet street. And she forgot the strikers and everything else in amazement at what had happened to the round-bellied, cigar-smoking leader. In some strange way, she knew not how, his head had become wedged at the neck between the tops of the pickets of her fence. His body hung down outside, the knees not quite touching the ground. His hat had fallen off, and the sun was making an astounding highlight on his bald spot. The cigar, too, was gone. She saw he was looking at her. One hand, between the pickets, seemed waving at her, and almost he seemed to wink at her jocosely, though she knew it to be the contortion of deadly pain. Possibly a second, or, at most, 2 seconds, she gazed at this when she was aroused by Bert's voice. He was running along the sidewalk, in front of her house, and behind him charged several more strikers, while he shouted, "Come on, you Mohegans! We got him nailed to the cross." In his left hand he carried a pick handle, in his right revolver, already empty, for he clicked the cylinder vainly around as he ran. With an abrupt stop, dropping the pick handle, he whirled half about, facing Saxon's gate. He was sinking down, when he straightened himself to throw the revolver into the face of a scab who was jumping toward him. Then he began swaying, at the same time sagging at the knees and waist. Slowly, with infinite effort, he caught a gate picket in his right hand, and, still slowly, as if lowering himself, sank down, while past him leaped the crowd of strikers he had led. It was battle without quarter, a massacre. The scabs and their protectors, surrounded, backed against Saxon's fence, fought like cornered rats, but could not withstand the rush of 100 men. Clubs and pick handles were swinging, revolvers were exploding, and cobblestones were flung with crushing effect at arm's distance. Saxon saw young Frank Davis, a friend of Bert's, and a father of several months' standing, press the muzzle of his revolver against a scab's stomach and fire. There were curses and snarls of rage, wild cries of terror and pain. Mercedes was right. These things were not men. They were beasts, fighting over bones, destroying one another for bones. Jobs are bones. Jobs are bones. The phrase was an incessant iteration in Saxon's brain. Much as she might have wished it, she was powerless now to withdraw from the window. It was as if she were paralyzed. Her brain no longer worked. She sat numb, staring, incapable of anything save seeing the rapid horror before her eyes that flashed along like a moving picture film gone mad. She saw Pinkertons, special police, and strikers go down. One scab, terribly wounded, on his knees and begging for mercy, was kicked in the face. As he sprawled backward, another striker, standing over him, fired a revolver into his chest quickly and deliberately, again and again, until the weapon was empty. Another scab, backed over the pickets by a hand clutching his throat, had his face pumped by a revolver butt. Again and again, continually, the revolver rose and fell, and Saxon knew the man who wielded it, Chester Johnson. She had met him at dances and danced with him in the days before she was married. He had always been kind and good-natured. She remembered the Friday night after a City Hall band concert when he had taken her and 2 other girls to Tony's Tamale Grotto on 13th Street. And after that they had all gone to Pabst Cafe and drunk a glass of beer before they went home. It was impossible that this could be the same Chester Johnson. And as she looked, she saw the round-bellied leader, still wedged by the neck between the pickets, draw a revolver with his free hand, and, squinting horribly sidewise, press the muzzle against Chester's side. She tried to scream a warning. She did scream, and Chester looked up and saw her. At that moment the revolver went off, and he collapsed prone upon the body of the scab. And the bodies of 3 men hung on her picket fence. Anything could happen now. Quite without surprise, she saw the strikers leaping the fence, trampling her few little geraniums and pansies into the earth as they fled between Mercedes' house and hers. Up Pine Street, from the railroad yards, was coming a rush of railroad police and Pinkertons, firing, as they ran. While down Pine Street, gongs clanging, horses at a gallop, came three patrol wagons packed with police. The strikers were in a trap. The only way out was between the houses and over the backyard fences. The jam in the narrow alley prevented them all from escaping. A dozen were cornered in the angle between the front of her house and the steps. And as they had done, so were they done by. No effort was made to arrest. They were clubbed down and shot down to the last man by the guardians of the peace, who were infuriated by what had been wreaked on their brethren. It was all over, and Saxon, moving, as in a dream, clutching the banister tightly, came down the front steps. The round-bellied leader still leered at her and fluttered one hand, though two big policemen were just bending to extricate him. The gate was off its hinges, which seemed strange, for she had been watching all the time, and had not seen it happen. Bert's eyes were closed. His lips were blood-flecked, and there was a gurgling in his throat, as if he were trying to say something. As she stooped above him, with her handkerchief brushing the blood from his cheek, where someone had stepped on him, his eyes opened. The old defiant light was in them. He did not know her. The lips moved, and faintly, almost reminiscently, he murmured, "The last of the Mohegans, the last of the Mohegans." Then he groaned, and the eyelids drooped down again. He was not dead. She knew that. The chest still rose, and fell, and the gurgling still continued in his throat. She looked up. Mercedes stood beside her. The old woman's eyes were very bright, her withered cheeks flushed. "Will you help me carry him into the house?" Saxon asked. Mercedes nodded, turned to a sergeant of police, and made the request to him. The sergeant gave a swift glance at Bert, and his eyes were bitter and ferocious, as he refused. "To hell with him. We'll care for our own." "Maybe you and I can't do it," Saxon said. "Don't be a fool." Mercedes was beckoning to Mrs. Olson, across the street. "You go into the house, little mother, that is to be. This is bad for you. We'll carry him in. Mrs. Olson is coming, and we'll get Maggie Donahue." Saxon led the way into the back bedroom which Billy had insisted on furnishing. As she opened the door, the carpet seemed to fly up into her face, as with the force of a blow, for she remembered Bert had laid that carpet. And as the women placed him on the bed, she recalled that it was Bert and she, between them, who had set the bed up one Sunday morning. And then she felt very queer, and was surprised to see Mercedes regarding her with questioning, searching eyes. After that, her queerness came on very fast, and she descended into the hell of pain that is given to women alone to know. She was supported, half-carried, to the front bedroom. Many faces were about her: Mercedes, Mrs. Olson, Maggie Donahue. It seemed she must ask Mrs. Olson if she had saved little Emil from the street, but Mercedes cleared Mrs. Olson out to look after Bert, and Maggie Donahue went to answer a knock at the front door. From the street came a loud hum of voices, punctuated by shouts and commands, and from time to time there was a clanging of the gongs of ambulances and patrol wagons. Then appeared the fat, comfortable face of Martha Shelton, and, later, Dr. Huntley came. Once, in a clear interval, through the thin wall, Saxon heard the high-opening notes of Mary's hysteria. And, another time, she heard Mary repeating over and over, "I'll never go back to the laundry. Never. Never."